So Dr. Mark Knight, it's been a while. We did the Labyrinth podcast together a while back.
That's right.
And we were telling the story of that, and through the journey of that, it actually featured on the Fellowship of the Woods film.
It did, didn't it? Yeah.
And yeah, it became embroiled in that. We keep becoming embroiled in each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ship's in the night for a bit.
That's right, we were, weren't we, for a long time.
And then suddenly, it's like, oh.
Actually, we're doing similar things, so let's do it together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. So we need to talk about this this thing you've found. I mean, how far do you want to go back? Because is it worth talking about the sort of Ulrus Witchner type stuff?
There's such a lot, isn't there, we can talk about. So I'll keep it as brief as I can without too much depth, but we need to do a little bit of background. So So I was until very recently the cultural heritage officer for Transforming the Trent Valley partnership. My role in that ended on September the 30th, but Staffordshire Wildlife Trust they want to keep me on for a while we put together another project funding bid, that kind of thing.
But the
whole point about cultural heritage is Staffordshire Wildlife Trust have stuck out their neck, really. It's a new thing for a wildlife trust, because you think, well, what has, you know, ecology and environmentalism got to do with cultural heritage? And that will become apparent, but we can get into that in a bit. The reality is, of course, that the historic environment has shaped the environment in which we live, and that affects the ecological environment, if you see what I mean.
Yep.
So, but we can talk more about that if we have time in a bit. If not, we'll just have to make another program. Specifically, we're here to talk about the National Memorial Arboretum and what we've been uncovering there on both their behalf and for Historic England. Historic England are the body that's responsible for looking after the nation's monuments. They were separated out from English Heritage. They were all part. It was just one big sort of government department, if you like. A few years ago, English Heritage still managed the tourism, the visits to sites, the castles, that, you know, that kind of thing. Historic England managed the sort of legal functioning of how scheduled monuments work, how our historic environment is cared for.
And when you first started speaking to me about this stuff, the idea of scheduling wasn't anything that I'd heard before, and I needed you to sort of break that down for me a little bit. So,
okay,
it was about, it's the equivalent of what I understand, like a grade two, how a building would be.
That's part of the same system. So if you list a building, buildings of national importance are given a listing, and they normally stand out in some way for having still representing a lot of their original features. And the more important they are, the higher the listing. So you can get grade two, grade two star, and grade one. There there are fewer grade ones than there are grade two stars, and fewer grade two stars than there are grade twos, if you see what I mean. There we go. And then other types of monument that grading system, that listing system, is managed by the local government department, and in our case that's South Derbyshire District Council. In Burton it would be East Staffs Borough Council, etc. You get the idea. But the actual listing itself is given by Historic England on behalf of the Secretary of State. So anything that is given a scheduled status is of national importance. And there are thousands of things that are of national importance, and many of them are below ground heritage sites, and that what that means is they are under the surface of the soil with no upstanding remains whatsoever,
which is crazy, isn't it? That's hidden
from us. We can't see that, and very often that's under farmland. And once that becomes a scheduled monument and therefore is of national significance, the farmer then has a series of impositions, in a way, placed on him the way that he has to manage that monument. Because they are, some of these monuments are, you know, more than 5,000 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are fragile and likely to be plowed away. The simple matter of it is, you know, and they'll be lost. And once you've lost one, you can't replace it. It's gone. It's gone forever. You can make a facsimile or a replica in some way, but it's not the thing.
Yeah.
The thing's gone forever. So that's why they need to be protected by having they're listed they're scheduled on a list effectively, and they become a scheduled monument. They used to be called SAMs, scheduled ancient monuments, but now you can get more modern than ancient. They're still worthy of scheduling and protection.
There's something about stewardship here, isn't there?
There is a great deal about that, and that really is the thing. And that is actually, Chris, what you've done there is hit on a really key word or phrase for what the landowner is. He's the steward of these for the nation.
Yeah.
Or he or she, they are the steward of our shared cultural heritage. They're the stewards of that. And the vast majority are incredibly proud of the fact that they've got that, you know, these things have been there 5,000 years. We're here in the blink of an eye and gone in the blink of an eye in comparison.
Yeah.
And most people recognise that, and the fact that they are the guardians and stewards of that heritage for the nation, for the future.
Mm.
And the vast majority of our landowners are completely respectful and care very deeply about the land that they are stewards of.
Yeah.
The other side to that coin, the flip side to that coin, is they also need to make a living.
You
know, and we also need the products of what they do, the food that they grow, you know, on that land. So we all want those things, and it's the finding the balance between how we protect our heritage for the future, how we feed ourselves, feed our nation, and how the landowner individually can make a living off that. So there are mechanisms for landowners to be paid in various levels of stewardship for how their land is managed.
Wow. Right, so there's a level of kind of grant financial support.
Yes, financial support for how they how they best care for
preserving,
that monument,
preserving that monument.
Yeah. It's actually become really quite complicated. And they're currently rolling out a new system that nobody. Well, obviously, some people understand it, but I certainly don't yet. I suspect most landowners don't, or land agents.
Yeah.
And we're sort of all in this middle ground grey area at the moment, feeling our way forward. And how that becomes rolled out by the government to best protect our monuments and best subsidise or make payments to our farmers for caring for those things.
So
that's sort of scheduled monuments in a nutshell. It's way more complicated than that, but for now, that's a really good overview.
And it's an interesting idea of this, because we are so as culturally obsessed with ownership.
The idea
of ownership,
The idea of ownership, that's my thing.
Yeah.
But we're passing through effectively, aren't we? We are here briefly. Mm. Those things have been here thousands of years, and hopefully they'll be here in more thousands of years. And the importance of, and really what cultural heritage is about identity in the end.
Yeah.
And that can be your local identity, you know, the street you live in, the village or area of a town that you're from, you know, what county you're from.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. I live in Overseal. Mm. Overseal and Netherseal were transferred from Leicestershire to Derbyshire in 1897.
Wow. Right.
The government, the Victorian government at the time, was tidying up the borders. They were a bit scrappier, particularly around the Leicestershire-Derbyshire border. Very complicated. So they just, right, let's draw some lines on a map and people will move from one to the other. That has an effect on how we think about ourselves, who we are. I'd always believed myself to be a Derbyshire lad, born and bred.
Yeah.
Actually, the village I live in was in Leicestershire for 1,000 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, from the formation of the counties up until the end of the 19th century.
So we tie our identity to a geography. Yeah.
To a geography, specifically to some. I mean, and this is where we get things like the and it can be to trees, for example, or hills or places in some way. The big kerfuffle you remember just a few years ago, and it's still kind of going on in Sheffield, where the council, hired in a private company to manage their street trees. Sheffield's well known as a green city.
Yes,
and they started hacking down trees, and because it's expensive to look after them, and it caused all manner of problems that people because people associate themselves and tie their identities so closely to those physical items.
The case in point being the Northumberland thing recently.
Right. Yeah, the cutting down of the sycamore gap tree. That's you know, stirred the public imagination in a way that you know, cutting down trees on a regular basis doesn't, because it's such a cultural icon.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Exactly. You know, it's used it's used in films, isn't it? Yeah, and people have tied themselves to that thing, and they identify themselves with that particular cultural item. And so our cultural heritage is of extraordinary significance that we don't even think about it because it's tied into who we are.
Yeah.
It's only when it becomes under threat that we start to really consider that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So with bearing that, all that in mind, and the nature of my job, Historic England had conducted a series of aerial photography studies of the country of post-war actually, but in I think it was 1983 they were sort of taking photographs along the River Tame, just where it comes into the River Trent near Olrhos, they were taking photographs of things they could see, crop marks on the ground that were looked like they might be of interest.
Gotcha.
And then they would investigate those at some later point. And crop marks are caused
by aliens.
Not by aliens. There's crop circles. And these are very often circular in nature, but they are crop marks, and they are caused by either parching or whatever the opposite of parching is.
What is parching? Because I don't know what
that is. So in a drier summer, the ground becomes parched, and the crop or plants or grasses or whatever is on there will grow differently. Now, the drier summer will have an effect on the crop growth.
Got it. Okay.
And where there has been, let's say, a ditch cut in the past that's then filled, that has that the soil is of is not compacted as it might feel or look the same, but it's not as compacted as the natural. Or the natural surface. So, and I'm talking about subsurface. So, you know, even though the soil is ploughed on the top, the subsurface, the subsoil, which may have contained a ditch in the past and be then filled, will have a different level of compaction. So it will be slightly softer, and therefore it will hold moisture better.
Okay.
Yeah. So from the air, what that means is you can see a patch of different coloured crop. So you've grown a grass crop that year, and it's become parched, and the grass goes slightly yellower. Where the ditch has been, it will retain a level of greener colour.
Gotcha.
Because it's got more moisture in the soil, so you can see that difference.
So ultimately, and I've got to simplify this for my brain to work.
Yeah,
it's almost like. What's that thing called on the Ordnance Survey maps? You know, when you've got
contour lines.
Yeah, so it's almost like contour lines underneath the surface that you can actually see by the colour of the grass a bit.
You get that kind of thing. So you can see from photographs originally, and sometimes on the ground you can see that. You know, it's so obvious. So
you get a perceived sense of the. Height or depth of something from the colour of the grass.
You can see that something has been there because of the colour of the grass or the crop. And that also, I mean, that might even show up, is rare, but it might even show up post-ploughing. But the trouble is that the surface soil that the crop grows in tends to be ploughed and ploughed and ploughed. And it's with the advent of industrial farming techniques, essentially... the motorized tractor and the deep ploughing that we've destroyed inadvertently, we've destroyed a lot of our Wow. Ancient.
So not on purpose, just by doing what we do. I mean, it's not a vandalism thing.
Not really. I mean, there was a great deal of, in the sort of 17th and 18th centuries, there was a great deal of, and a little bit before that even, people trying to plough out burial mounds because they're in the middle of a field and it's causing the farmer a problem with his ploughing.
But it's not erasing history on purpose.
Not deliberately. There was people like Stonekiller Robinson, as he was nicknamed, when he was trying to break down the stones at Avebury. There can be ideological reasons. Yeah. Oh, this is where pagans come, and we're going to, But the vast majority just people trying.
But that's not what this is. What we're talking about here is people doing their job
and doing their job, not realizing the significance of what they're ploughing away. In effect, I think it's Historic England. You know, in they'll say that almost every parish in the country had at least one burial mound in it.
Yeah,
at some point in the past, the vast majority have gone. They've been ploughed out. So a
burial mound being just, again, I'm just trying to break it down a little bit. A burial mound being where, rather than digging a grave, it was bodies interred into a hill of some description.
A man-made hill.
These
vary in type over a long period of time. This didn't start happening until the Neolithic period, which is dates in England, in Britain, to about 6,000 years ago,
when
people stopped being hunter-gatherers and adopted a pastoral lifestyle and began agriculture. Something changed in the mindset, and we start to see burial mounds, stone circles, wooden circles, depending on where you are in the country, what kind of material you've got.
Portraying the idea of settlement, the idea of dwelling.
And then you start to get the idea of land ownership in some sense.
Yeah,
everybody lives still communally. Mm. You had to survive.
Yeah,
but you get this sort of settling down of people and areas being set aside for food production.
Yeah,
a good old friend of mine is no longer with us. He used to say that all mankind's problems start with bread. Because when you start to grow a crop for bread and begin to produce flour for bread, you've suddenly got a very cheap, very bulky food source that actually people's health deteriorates because you're now relying on effectively a single source of nutrition, which is largely bread. And a single source of nutrition isn't good for the human body, obviously. So people's health from between that hunter-gatherer period and the advent of farming, you can start to see deterioration in health, but more people, you can support a bigger population.
So
people, suddenly the amount of people booms.
That quality of health.
The quality of health goes down a little bit. Yeah. People still, they start to, drink a lot more milk and you're starting to rely on that kind of food sourcing as well. So jumping forward, right to the advent of flight, we now start to take, and certainly post Second World War, we've got a lot of these well-trained pilots who are now going out and flying across the country, taking photographs of the landscape, starting to notice these anomalies in the ground and realizing that they relate to archaeology.
This is predominantly, you wouldn't see it walking across it. You wouldn't see it in amongst it.
No, you can't see it.
It's that aerial view.
Yeah, it's the aerial view.
By zooming out from above and looking upon it,
you
then start to see the
patterns. You then start to see the patterns in the ground, and then you can start to wonder what they are, realise their archaeology. And
this was the 80s.
This was post-war. It really got going in the 60s.
Okay.
By the 80s, it was almost become, not quite an industry, but certainly people like English Heritage were using that. I don't think they were formed then. So whatever was that, the Royal Commission, was it? Were using that to inform their understanding of the landscape.
So it was effectively, again, just bringing it up to the sort of current day.
It was
Google Maps and Street View and that sort of
stuff.
Of its time.
And actually you can start to use Google Maps and historic Google Maps. For example, 2018 was a particularly dry year, and it was a great year for archaeology in the sense that you could see more of it.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
So, and you can start to use satellite imagery. Mm. Anybody can. It suddenly democratized the search from, you know, former Spitfire pilots, highly trained individuals being able to go out and photograph it, to everybody's now got the opportunity.
Yeah.
Not to the level of detail, but you've got the opportunity to look at it, because using a plane and a plane camera, you get to look. I mean, you ideally, you do it in a mid-winter sunny day, you know, where you get this sort of, this is for features that stand above the ground a little bit. You get that raking light that casts shadows that you can see. For the stuff we're talking about with the parch marks and the, you know, that you can do with satellite imagery. And we have used that, you know, as part of our search.
So like, that's really horrendous though, in that it takes an international war to develop the level of technology to be able to kind of like inform and equip humans with the next level of understanding. That's crazy, really, if you think about that.
And it's wonderful that you can take that sort of militaristic development and put it to civil use. And we can benefit in a different way, you know.
Well, we'll talk about pillboxes another day.
Pillboxes, that's another story, isn't it? But for now, so we got to 1983. The photograph, there was a flying over Ulruas, saw this.
Oh, man, that was a hell of a leap that was. We went, bosh,
So, so we're back in Ulruas. We're back by the side of the River Tame at the confluence of the Trent. Mm. Again, another really significant point in the ancient past, because of the third river, the River Meese, coming in, much smaller river, but coming in. So there's a confluence of three rivers. Mm. We're going to have to talk about that separately. But the reason
that has
a significant impact on where our ancient monuments are. All the Trent Valley, the Tame, not all of it, but the significant parts of it are incredibly important in the ancient past, and a lot of it is focused on that confluence of the three rivers. This particular confluence of those two rivers, the Tame coming into the Trent, is where the focus for this particular photograph was taken. The photograph was taken because of the marking in the ground, which appeared to be a sort of like a bullseye.
It's a sort of
a circle in the middle, with then two further concentric rings outside it. The outer one being around about 34, 35 meters across. Realized that was probably what they call in a hengiform monument. So they didn't know exactly what it was. They knew it could be a barrow mound, you know, a tumulus or a burial mound of some kind. It could be a hengiform monument. And a henge, we think of Stonehenge and we think of the stones that stand there. Actually, the henge itself is the ditch and the mound that's usually on the outside of it.
Is it really?
Yeah. That is
the stones themselves aren't the henge?
That's not a henge. That's a stone circle. The henge is the ditch and mound.
Yeah.
Or the ditches and mounds in our case.
Yeah.
What we believe to be these circular, this bullseye monument.
Yeah.
When you look at, the rest of all the stuff that was there is gone. It's been quarried away, but this particular monument was considered significant enough to protect.
And when you say quarry, we're talking about coal and things like that.
It's in the Trent Valley. So the Trent Valley is quarried extensively and still is. For sand and gravel.
Hence all the building aggregate.
You go along the Trent Valley, there's loads of former gravel pits that are now it could be wildlife sites or whatever, also lots of active quarries along the Trent Valley.
So is that the same thing to do with the quarry around where Phenadoc is, and we did this Fellowship of the Woods and all that sort of stuff?
That would have been quarried for coal.
That was coal.
Because you're out of the Trent Valley, you're out of the River Valley and you're into the coal measures. But those in the Trent Valley are all for sand and gravel. So where we are there, we've got this bullseye sort of looking monument.
And you've got the picture of that. You can see that from 1983.
From 1983. Okay. It's a great photo. And it shows a little stream that's now gone. Because that's been quarried out as well. Where the course of the stream is now, I don't know, but obviously it's moved. But anyway, so that was scheduled as an ancient monument to protect it. but it was just a little area. Then in the early 1990s, or the late 1980s, actually, but 89, that area was going to be, it was a company called Redland Aggregates, I think they were. They're part of Tarmac now.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, they were, Redland Aggregates wanted to develop a quarry there, and part of their planning permission, they had to get in archaeologists for a watching brief, and because there was lots of other things there, very much from the aerials, you can't see it now because it's been quarried out, but from the aerial photographs and the transcripts of those onto maps, it looks very much like there was some kind of processional avenue and other burial mounds, much smaller ones.
Yeah.
Assuming this is a burial mound, much smaller ones. Sort of around the periphery of, you know, dotted in the landscape. So there was a watching brief and some archaeological intervention at that time. They didn't do a dig, but they did do some level of geophysics work, as in the type of stuff you see on Time Team, walking up with the probe type stuff and measuring the ground resistance to see where the ditches are. And
that's the stuff you're talking about with the compacting of the, of the materials that you spoke about.
Because the resistivity... when you put it only has to be like a 9-volt battery in your machine, but it measures the resistivity of the soil between the two prongs that you poke into the ground on a frame, a meter apart, and where that resistivity is low is where there's been a ditch, where it's been high is where there's been, let's say, a wall or stones or something in the ground. It can be natural or otherwise, but you can start to piece together a kind of map, like a horizontal two-dimensional map of the surface, and it tells you whether or not there's a ditch or a wall or a mound or a whatever that is there, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So they did some resistivity work, and then when they started, they realized they got to protect this particular area, and when they started work, the operators at the time accidentally strayed into the area, not into the area of the circles, but into the area of the protected zone, quite by chance. It wasn't deliberate.
Yeah.
And when they were piling the spoil up, somebody noticed some pottery.
Okay. Wow. Right.
A fairly sizable chunk of pot that is dates to the early Bronze Age.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was realised that they'd gone too close to the monument. And although you have to read between the lines of the report, they found it by accident.
Yeah.
You know, and it was in the outer edges of the monumental area.
Yeah.
And that's now on show, that piece of pot. It's a sizable chunk. It's probably, you know, 300 mil long, a couple of hundred mil wide,
wow,
and it's
right,
patterned,
you
know, and it was probably the funerary pot for, and it contained the ashes of somebody significant.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was placed in association with this Hengiform monument. So then when English Heritage scheduled it, whoever drew the map put it in the wrong place.
Right, right.
So we were asked, this is a long way around to the, around to why we were asked, because we've got a team of really enthusiastic volunteers, we were asked if we would investigate, using some geophysics, the precise location of where the monument is on the ground. So in the interim, the area was quarried out. It was then handed over to create the National Memorial Arboretum.
Right.
A focus for memorialization for the nation in more or less the center of the country.
Yeah.
Close to the, you know, the road networks, the motorway networks, that kind of thing. So people from all over the country can come and visit this memorial site. Obviously there's no bodies there or anything like that.
Going full circle back, it's back to it's the war, isn't it?
War, and then also, so there's a lot of military remembrance there, you know, sort of regimental sites and you know, various the branches of the military, the RAF, the Navy, that kind of thing. But there's also stuff that's for non-military, for civilian memorialization. So there's memorials to NHS, to miners, to the railway workers, all sorts of things.
Yeah, even there's a bit for COVID, isn't there? There's a bit for
that's
that
right.
As well.
And the particularly moving one I found for the Shot at Dawn people, you know.
But
anyway, when
Just to say, I mean, if people are listening to this from not this area and some of these words that we're talking about with the locality don't make sense to you, just search for that place, the National Memorial Arboretum.
Yes.
Because it's
an astonishing place.
It's an unbelievable place.
It elicits different feelings from different people, I think.
Yeah.
Mine is not quite a bafflement.
Yeah.
But just trying to get my mind around what's going on there, yes, and what's being represented there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the ride to the wall.
Yeah.
Motorcyclists.
All over the world. And that was, yes, like we're recording this like early October 2023, whenever you catch this, you know. But this is the day we've actually ironically recorded this, or coincidentally recorded this, the day after the ride to the wall this year,
which I wanted to go to. It's an astonishing thing in itself, isn't it?
It's a spectacle, hundreds
or thousands of motorcyclists all converging on this site.
Yeah.
A lot of whom, but not necessarily all of whom by any means, have got a connection with, you know, some kind of regimental connection or something.
Yeah,
but lots of others come because the sort of the pertinence of the site to them in some way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Oh, I suspect others just want to go a big ride out with a lot of other motorcyclists
and properly enjoy that as well.
And that's fine too. You know, it serves a lot of purposes.
Yeah.
So the site, the Memorial Arboretum site, there was an incorrect area drawn on the map.
Yeah.
Then once the Memorial Arboretum got going and they were sort of starting to develop site, put more and more memorials in, they knew they had to avoid the scheduled area. They interpreted the scheduled area slightly differently and actually much closer to where it really is. And they keep that as a kind of wildflower area.
They've left it alone.
Essentially,
they've not put monuments on there. They've not done that because they recognise that it's scheduled and it needs...
Yeah, and it's got its own memorial on there, or its own monument site is there anyway.
Yeah.
Now, so we need to just flip back briefly again, 1950s-ish.
Yeah.
Some farmer obviously didn't know there was a site, anything on there, cut a sort of a straight area, as it happens, cut about a third of the monument away.
Yeah.
And I suspect that was for flooding management, essentially.
Right, yeah.
Because the river Thames floods.
Because it's quite close to the
river,
isn't it?
You're right in that washland, that floodplain area. And then fenced along it, and there was a public footpath along the side of it, much where there's a path now, actually.
Right.
And the sort of metalled path follows the public footpath. I think that's deliberate on behalf of the, you know, the Arboretum site. So when it was protected, the quarrying came up very close to the edge of it. And when we did our geophysics, we could see the extent of the quarry.
Yeah, yeah.
And that quarried away everything. It quarried away the potential processional route. It quarried away the old field boundaries and... anything that had gone before, destroyed forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Infield, the Arboretum come on site, make it look beautiful, start to put their monuments onto there. And then it's important then that they know the exact location as well so they can introduce their monuments, their modern monuments, without interfering with the scheduled monument.
Got it. Okay, yeah.
So that's why we were there. So we went on site with a team of, most of them retired, either geologists, teachers, that kind of thing. And they've taken an interest in archaeology through using geophysics.
Yeah. So like a hobbyist.
Essentially, yeah. And I'd worked with them before I got this job.
Yeah.
And then I hoped that they would, and they did, because it's in the Trent Valley, it's near where they live.
Yeah, yeah.
They've sort of come along to help me and help our other volunteers as well. So we've been able to train our other volunteers, the Triple TV volunteers, in the methods of geophysics that they perhaps watched when they were younger on Time Team, that kind of thing, because kind of Time Team generation almost, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So now we are able to put those things that they used to see on telly into practice for themselves. We've been able to train them. Our geophysics team have got extra people to help them with other projects. And everybody benefits.
Yeah, yeah. And just that Triple TV, that's Transforming the Trent Valley Trust.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
It's fine. It's just for reference if people didn't know what that meant.
Yeah. So you can find, we will eventually have the results of this particular discussion on our website. Not there yet, but loads of other stuff on there about cultural heritage.
Mm.
But anyway, So we started to conduct this investigation in July of this year.
It's come from out of nowhere, hasn't it, really?
It feels really like it. All of a sudden, we got permission to get on there because, of course, it's a scheduled monument site. So I had to apply for a Section 42 licence, it's called, from Historic England. Even though Historic England wanted us to investigate it, I still had to have a licence in place and fill in all the appropriate forms to get that in place because it has to be signed off. Sorry?
We love a form.
And government departments really love forms. They really, really like their paperwork. And I mean, it's for good reason. Everything has to be kept, you know, correctly administered. And they have to give permission on behalf of the Secretary of State for anything to happen. Even though we're not doing any kind of intrusive work, all we're doing is walking across the top of the fields, across the top of that particular bit of field, if you like. But we're investigating it, and therefore we have to have a license, and we have to fill in a proper report and all the rest of it.
Which in itself is history, isn't it? It's creating history with that.
We are now keeping a record of what we found at this point in time, and you know who was there doing it, and what we found, and how we found it, so that it can be replicated in future. We're going to provide all that data for people to then research. They might have better ways of interrogating that data in future. You know that electronic data. So we may well be able to do that in future. But for now, we got on the ground, had 3 days of essentially mapping the area out into 20 metre by 20 metre square grids, which we then put down lines, which we walk along and take a reading every metre. So that means each 20 by 20 metre grid has 400 individual data points. And then we did... how many did we do? I can't remember, but it added up to 10,000, whatever that is. I can't just think. That must be...
Just numbers, mate. It's big numbers.
Five, 25 grids, I reckon. So it took us 3 days to do, because you just got to walk up and down.
And just to say, like, because I came down and sort of hung out at various points during this, and like, I had a word with some of the volunteers about this, and one of the questions I asked them was like, you know, what's like the biggest one you've ever done? And they went, oh, this one. We've done like bits before, but this is the one. This is a big one.
This is a big one. The other one that we've done that was sort of comparable was at the Roman fort site that we uncovered. We kind of knew it was, again, from aerial photography. And we might have to talk about that separately, but that's on the Walton-Drakelow boundary. And we definitely found a double-ditched rectilinear enclosure that we... there's no doubt in my mind. This is a Roman fort from the point of the Roman conquest. This is an advanced fort right up against the river. But anyway, blimey, there's such a lot to talk about, isn't there? So what we discovered was we really did geolocate very accurately the Hengiform monument. What we were also able to do. Two of our researchers, two of the volunteer team that did the geophysics, they're doing a lot of work around Cork Abbey, by the way, at the moment. There'll be a lot come out of that. That's nothing to do with me. That's their particular sort of research area at the moment. But two of those people are able to manipulate LIDAR. Now, LIDAR is, again, this came, did it come from the military? I think it did. No, it didn't. Originally, it was for use for weather. But anyway, LIDAR is light detection and ranging. And essentially, you fly a laser, originally in a plane, but now you can do it by drone, over the surface of the ground, and you shoot a laser at the ground and then measure the refraction or the light or the speed, depending on what kind of LIDAR it is that you're doing back to your source. And it's used in military for accurately sort of locating the range of enemies. It's used in your, from 2020, it's used in your iPhone to rapidly assess the distance between the phone and the target and get better. So if you're trying to take a photograph of a moving image of a moving subject, that LIDAR reacts almost nanoseconds.
Wow, right,
you know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
So it's used in your iPhone from 2020.
Yeah.
And iPads as well, I think, from 2020.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For taking photographs. But it's used for archaeology in locating height differences in the topography, so in the landscape.
Yeah.
And you can then identify what are effectively man-made structures, whether that be circular, rectangular, whatever. And it's been used, you can use it. It was used in the Amazon to locate Mayan cities, for example.
Yeah.
But in our case, the Environment Agency in, I think, about 2010, maybe, they used LIDAR to map the river systems for their benefit.
Yeah.
But that information has been made publicly available, and you can go onto the web and just type in LIDAR UK or LIDAR Map UK.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can find all sorts of different people are offering you different ways of looking at that. that availability is there. But two of our researchers are able to, yeah, it's something you can just look at, but there's a skill to interpreting it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once you can then download the information, the data, and manipulate it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Environment Agency make it freely available to anybody who's got the skills to do that.
Wow.
And they have the skills. And what they were able to do, what they noticed by enhancing the depth by 10 times.
Yeah.
So you can see it by eye, because otherwise it's really hard to see.
Yeah.
That Hengiform monument is on an artificially raised platform, which is more like 80 to 90 meters across. So somebody in the ancient past has raised up a great big, near perfectly circular area.
Yeah.
Perfectly circular to the eye.
Yes, yeah.
Probably measured out with a rope and peg.
Yeah.
And then in that...
Like a massive compass.
Effectively, compass. Yeah. Drawn a big circle and raised up a mound in it, flat-topped mound, or a flat mound. And then into that, they've created a Hengiform monument, a series of circular ditches and banks. The banks are on the outside, so it's not defensive in nature.
Mm.
It's probably religious in nature in some way.
Yes.
That's the bit where we now enter the realms of we start to interpret the information. We gather the information up.
Yeah.
There's lots of it here on bits of paper.
We'll talk through that in a minute, because just to say at this point, there's in my mind, I'm calling this podcast Scratching the Surface.
Yeah.
Because at some point, we are going to dig deeper into this, aren't we?
We are,
together.
Yeah.
And there's an accompanying film. So the film that I visited the site to see you, and we put together this film. There's a bit of you talking on it, and actually, some of the audio that you're going to hear now is now going to feature on that film with some of these images.
Yes.
So if whatever Mark's describing, you can't visualize that in your mind, just nip on and find this film.
Yes. And Scratching the Surface, and we'll host it through our Transforming the Trent Valley website, which if you need to just go to thetrentvalley.org.uk and then be able to navigate to cultural heritage from there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what do we see from these images?
The geophysics images show a series of concentric circles about 34, 35 metres across. The outer one is of a fairly substantial size. What you can also see is a sort of rectangular area around it, and that was the boundary of the quarry. So they quarried up quite close to the monument itself. And I think what we also see sometimes in the aerial photography is a fence line. Now, I think the fence line to the east corresponded to the area that was cut away, presumably by the landowner in the middle of the 20th century to act as that sort of defense for water, from flood defense.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
And although we still did a geophysics survey of that area, and you can see the deepest of the ditches. That's the ones to the right of this image, to the east of this image. What you can see there is how deep that ditch must have been originally, because he's cut a good... When you're standing there, it's the best part of a meter from the base of that to the top of that mound, and yet the ditch edge is still visible. The outer ditch is still visible in that bit. And then, because that was believed, because there was a fence across that was thought to be, I think that was presumed to be the boundary of the monument area modern monuments have been put on that.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So they do impinge
very, very slightly on
onto the monument, the ancient monument.
Because in my mind, from visiting the site, I look at that image and think all about the open bit, but it's not, is it?
No.
It's about probably 3/4 of the way across the circle.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that the landowner at the time did that kind of cutting away, because that gave a false edge to the monument that isn't real, But anyway, what's left is still valuable, you know, because we can see that outer ring still anyway, even though there's modern monuments and cutaway earth, we can still see it in the geophysics. That gives us that, you know, picture of that large circular hengiform monument, that then there's an inner ring that we can see, and then a pit that we can see. And then if we look at the next image, which our researchers did with the LIDAR, that is an exaggerated by 10 times view of the sort of,
It sounds like from the side almost a little bit.
So they what they've done is give
you've gone on Google Earth, you zoomed in a bit, and then you've just like cocked the camera back. That's what it looks like,
and that's what they're able to do. So what they've done by exaggerating it 10 times, this sort of to the upper left of the image is the modern
the Gates of Dawn, whatever it's called.
That huge central monument. And that looks like a, you know, almost mountainous, but, you know, remember that's exaggerated 10 times.
Yeah.
The same with this. And then what they've done is draped the geophysics over the topography.
Oh, so the image of the geophysics is
draped then over the top of the LIDAR image.
So you've got the mound, and then the dark parts are the ditches that would have been dug into the mound. Have I got that right, or have I got that wrong?
Yes, that's correct. Correct. The dark parts are the low resistance ditch areas.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've draped that onto a LIDAR imagery and then put that onto Google Earth. This, you know, this is the brilliance of technology and people's genius in being able to manipulate all of that. So we're now looking, but what they've done is exaggerated it 10 times in its sort of height coming up from the ground. So it looks like mountains. It's not anything like that, as you know, in reality.
Yes.
But what that does is it gives us that ability to appreciate that that false mound that's been created 5,000 years ago, in which they then placed the monument. So that gives us a sort of, and you can also see from that that area to the east, which is now sort of in the foreground, and the bend in towards the bend in the river, that where that was cut away by the landowner at the time as some kind of flood defense, is my opinion of what he was doing that for. And then we've also got the aerial photograph that kind of started it all, and that shows us it's like a target, isn't it? That's taken almost directly from above. It shows a stream coming into the river that's no longer there because it was quarried away and presumably, you know,
so
redirected.
This is the bit that was taken by the Spitfires.
Yeah.
Whatever it was.
Former Spitfire pilot, pilots and bomber pilots. Yeah. In this case, I don't know who took this particular photograph, but this photograph is on show in that sort of wooden structure that's near to the monument. You can go in and have a look at this. And it says on it, an aerial photograph of the triple ditched barrow or ancient burial mound, because that's what it was then interpreted as because of the pottery that was found in association with it. So the actual original scheduling mentions that it's a hengiform monument, and I think because of the later sort of association with the that Bell Beaker culture, it's been assumed that it was always a burial mound, and I think that the burial mound was placed there because of the former hengiform monument.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's my interpretation of what's going on, not necessarily fact.
Yeah.
But that's what I think is going on. So we've got that, and then we're able to look at another image that shows a sort of, you can see that yellow dotted shape. That's where the outer mound is, and then the rings inside that are the ditch mound. So you can see that wider 90 meter or so wide raised area that we're talking about, into which the hengiform monument was cut.
Got it. Wow. I mean, you ought to be proud of that.
I am, and the reality is, of course, I'm gonna be credited with all the glory, but actually the work was done by the volunteers.
Yeah,
you know, they have been key to the success of this whole, the whole project, not just at the Arboretum. They've been key to the success of the cultural heritage side of the Transforming the Trent Valley project, because they've been out in all weathers. I mean, we were out looking for a Roman road in some of the foulest weather. And one of the things they always point out to me is, yeah, we'll come, but we're not coming in that weather. And I don't blame them. Yeah. It was grim. It was cold. It was wet. It was, you know, everything was thrown at us. But they didn't moan. They just got on with it. And, you know, some of these people are well into their retirement. Into their retirement.
Yeah.
And, you know, not necessarily the greatest on their legs. But they're just full of enthusiasm, and it's inspirational. It really is. Working with some of these people is absolutely inspirational.
I mean, and all this work's just led to kind of brilliant things, really.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, and long may that continue. And I hope and I think that it will. We've got lots going on because it's a huge project that was largely about environmental improvement, but with my little bit sort of attached on, which now has become quite important.
I would say
more than quite important to the Staffordshire Wildlife Trust, and I think it's going to become, because of there's Natural England have recently released a report which ties cultural heritage directly to environmental.
Interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely. All of a sudden the world has woken up to the importance, and not that
and how everything is joined up is not discrete.
That's absolutely the key.
You
know, every single piece of our island, which, you know, is quite big to us, but, you know, has been affected by the activity of people in the past. Every field has got a name. You know, it's that kind of level of stuff. And we have affected the environment in ways that it's not incomprehensible, but it's huge. You know, it's really, so we've changed everything, and therefore what we do environmentally has an effect on that that cultural landscape, and therefore the two need now to work in tandem, particularly as we, you know, we rush headlong into a climate crisis of proportions that we can't really, I mean, we can imagine, but we can't really comprehend. The landscape is going to change dramatically, and we need to find ways to protect it and protect ourselves, both culturally and environmentally, and that's why we need to be working together, and that's why Natural England have released this report just within the last few weeks that tie that importantly together. Staffordshire Wildlife Trust, when they took on this role, that I wasn't originally in it, but I came into it when the other fella left. They took a massive leap into the dark. Why would a wildlife trust employ a cultural heritage officer? What's the connection? And I've been banging the drum for this for a little while, because we're working on projects on water meadows and that kind of thing, where if you didn't respect what was there before, you could just go in with the diggers, make it wonderful for wildlife, but destroy the archaeology. And that archaeology matters, because it's how we've affected the landscape in the past, and it tells our story of who we are and why we are the way we are and all the rest of that kind of thing. But we can protect both.
Oh God, so even ecological mindfulness can have cultural significance in a negative, detrimental way. A
detrimental effect on our cultural past. And it's not because people don't care.
It's all with good intentions.
It's all done with the best of intentions. You know, they want to make it a much better place. So we're doing
through encouraging biodiversity, in effect, you could be impacting heritage.
Absolutely. You've really got to think about everything you do. And that's why they've taken a bit of went out on a wing and a prayer with this position that I was in, and now it looks like I'm going to stay in for a little while. And they were the first wildlife trust in the country to do that. Warwickshire woke up recently to the fact that they needed one. They've still not grasped it. I looked at the job specification, and I don't think they've quite understood what it is they want. Because they're a wildlife trust, and what they do is wildlife trust stuff. Now they're coming round to this idea.
I just find it fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. People do things with the best will in the world, and the greatest of intentions. But actually, you could be erasing history.
It could be erasing
history.
In
the same way of quarrying something, or in the same way of farming something. Things we spoke about earlier.
Absolutely, you could. And in these cases, the historic environment is completely fragile. Mm. Just so the Trent Valley is of extraordinary significance to our national understanding of who we are and where we're from.
Yeah.
We just can't see it.
Yeah, yeah.
We just can't, because there's nothing, almost yeah. nothing from that so far back in the past.
Yeah.
That
and we're talking 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, right?
We're talking in the sort of region of 5,000
yeah.
years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So just downstream, down the Trent at Twyford, which is between Willington and Swarkston.
Yeah.
A little tiny village, seemingly of no consequence. Mm. There is a round barrow there from the Bronze Age. So that's probably, 3,000 years old, something of that order.
Yeah.
And that sits exactly centrally within a Neolithic henge. So the henge must have been there, still visible in the landscape.
Yeah.
When that barrow was created. The barrow, you can't visit it. It's on private land. And I do not recommend you go on there because you'll be trampling crops, upsetting the farmer, etc. But you can see it from the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, although there's not anywhere, it's a busy road. It's not worth the effort of going to that particular one where you can go to one that you can visit. You know, there's loads that you can visit. But, but this particular one is important because it's still visible to us.
Yeah. Could you just explain what a barrow is?
A barrow. So a barrow is, in this case, it's 30 metres across. It's circular. It's what's called a bowl barrow.
Yeah.
It's round. It looks like you filled a pudding bowl and tipped it upside down. And the jelly that came out is a perfect circle. Mm. And it's a round mound, if you like, but it's made of earth. It's 30 metres across and it stands now 3 metres high. Maybe it was 4 metres because it's had, you know, 3,000 years of weathering, whatever going on.
Yeah.
So it's lost some of its height. But that, and into that would be interred perhaps a single person, and then later other people might have been interred around the edges of it or that kind of thing, but they'd be buried in there. So it's essentially a burial mound.
Yeah.
But it acts as more than just a burial mound. This is that, you know, you what you're doing when you create that kind of size of monument in the landscape. You're saying, here we are, this is ours. You know, a person of significance from our clan is now the guardian of this space. I mean, I'm interpreting a little bit here,
but
somebody's gone into the ground. It's you know, when modern churchyards hold that similar kind of significance, that our families are in there, you know.
Almost their own little memorial arboretums.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, our own memorial, isn't it? You know, although this is with bodies.
Yeah.
And that's so, but when you look at the, so there are maps available online, the National Forest mapping map. I can't just think of the website, but hopefully we'll be able to add that information on to just go on and have a look of historic England have created these maps. Luckily ours is one of the areas that was part of that project. So all along the Trent and the Tame, they've mapped from aerial photography onto the ground what's there.
Yeah.
And there it is extraordinary. The stuff that was there. And when you think about how much have we lost, we don't know. Yeah. It was quarried out before the advent of being able to see it from the air.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot of it,
Victorian quarrying, for example.
Yeah.
And then throughout the 20th century, right up to the point where we suddenly started scheduling these monuments.
Yeah.
Because it was important to the nation.
Mm.
And the Trent Valley was a sacred valley with a sacred river running through it 5,000 years ago, maybe longer into the, you know, because we don't know how far back, but what we can say, at least it was here when monuments started to be created along the river and they're associated with the river.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of things that we can't really go into a description of what they are, but there are, you know, causewayed enclosures, henges, cursuses, burial mounds. There's a site at Catterham, again, nothing to see, private land, but there's nothing to see anyway if you go on there. It's just some farmland.
Yeah.
There are monuments there that are utterly unique in the world. There are no other monuments like them anywhere in the world.
Yeah. So it's a big statement here, but the situation of the Trent on a kind of a small scale is almost like the English Nile.
Yes, yeah, or the Indus.
The Indus, it's
significant on a scale like that, you know.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of people, and, you know, we're probably put into the water
yeah.
when they were dead,
yeah.
you know, or I mean, again, we don't know that for certain. I'm supposing a little bit here in a way.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, the river was sacred, and some of these ceremonial complexes were created because of that, and especially because of that three river confluence that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. The Meuse, the Tame, and the Trent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the well. We're going to be digging deeper on that, aren't we?
We'll dig deeper. Yeah. We'll dig deeper.
So coming back to the Arboretum, back to the Hengiform mound monument that was discovered there.
Yeah.
So we've got the map in. We now know where it is.
We do,
because of your team's work.
Yep.
And I suppose there's probably a little bit for us to do about talking about those results.
We do need to talk about those results now, because part of what I've got to do next is write a designation review to send to Historic England, and we'll base that on how we interpret those results.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what we can say is that we definitely found evidence. I'm just having a look at the aerial sort of view, if you will, of our geophysics results. We found absolute definite evidence of the outer ring, an inner ring, and then a what presumably is some kind of pit in the center. What it was used for is open to interpretation. I don't know. But we also found, well, at first I thought, wow, we found another burial mound immediately next to it.
Yeah.
But what that turned out to be was a flower bed from 2017.
Oh, wow.
That was dug in 2017, quite close. Again, probably accidentally.
Mm.
And again, actually, that area wasn't scheduled.
No.
You know, the scheduling is in the wrong place. So whilst the people at the Arboretum were respecting the fact that it's, you know, effectively a monument and keeping it as a wildflower meadow, they'd also put in a flower bed and then realised, oh, my word, we put this in the wrong place.
Yeah.
We'll take it back out.
Got rid of it, but actually now it's impacted that.
It's impacted the area, and retains this circle.
Yeah.
There's a circle feature that we now have, because we can go back on Google Maps and realise there was a flower bed there.
Yeah.
You know, we can interpret it as what it was, but we could have easily got that wrong, because I thought we'd found a burial mound.
A smaller burial mound.
When I first looked at it, I thought, blimey, what we got? Oh, nothing.
Yes.
Oh, actually, it's not nothing. It's a flower bed that shouldn't really have been there.
But you can see that, can't you? Look at, like, if you're stood on the side of the of the square, the area.
Yeah,
you
where the grass is growing longer.
You can actually see it.
Because one of our volunteers had been there over the summer and sent me photographs and said, what's this?
Yeah.
Looks like there's some kind of mound or is the... They thought maybe it could be where the Hengiform monument is and showing a different colour in the grass. But no, it's a flower bed.
So we've got the aerial photography, the kind of aerial view, if you like.
The horizontal view. And then we also did something called a pseudo section, which you came and had a look at the time. A pseudo section is cutting an electronic resistance trench into the ground. It cuts a slice vertically.
Yeah.
So we ran two, an east west and a north south across the where we knew now the ditches, the circular forms were.
So you got the two, right, again, I'm really oversimplifying this, but you've got the two prong thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the resistivity thing.
Yeah, you walk up and down with that.
Yeah, you've got the, what you just said.
Pseudo section.
And that's the bit where you put the, like, what look like canes along the ground.
Yeah.
Then you had the kind of electric.
The metal spikes. You clip a wire onto that and then take a reading of the resistance across that. And you do that at every metre.
Yeah.
And then you do it at 2 metres, and then you do it at 3 metres and four, up until 6 metres, I think.
Yeah.
And what that does, each time the further apart it goes, the deeper into the ground it goes.
Yeah.
So what you're doing is looking at a slice into the ground.
Yeah.
It's like as if you took a slice of cake and then looked at the layers in the cake.
Yeah.
And what that does is allows us to see how deep the remains of the ditches are. It's only in the subsoil, remember. Yeah. But they were still 1.2 metres or 4 feet or so deep.
Right,
so and remember that this has been ploughed out.
Yeah,
so these were substantial ditches into the subsoil with a mound above them.
Yeah.
So with a ring of soil around them. So the earth that was excavated by hand from these ditches was then piled up on the outside.
Yeah, to create some form of
creating some
physical barrier,
monument of some kind.
A statement of Earth.
And what that was used for, we can only really guess at.
Yeah.
There are no written records from that period. We can do comparative sort of anthropology, if you like, and see what. But that, you know, that's great. It gives us lots of information, but it's also dangerous to just assume that what's something that's happening in, let's say, South Africa or South America or, you know, sort of anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Is the same as here.
Yeah.
It's not.
No.
It might be similar, but it might not.
Mm.
You know, so we are using comparative techniques to theorize about what these monuments were and meant. They clearly meant something for so much communal effort to go into the creation of these monuments in the past. I could go on endlessly what I think they are, and maybe we will when we go dig deeper. But again, that'll be my opinion rather than fact. You know, we can.
But the fact that we've got is, you can see from the images, correct, that there is a Hengiform monument.
There's a Hengiform monument there, which may well have been something that was created in the Neolithic 5,000 years ago thereabouts, and then reused, much like the Twyford Barrow that I mentioned, and that's why it's relevant, for a barrow mound in the early Bronze Age, or, you know, sort of that sort of Bell Beaker people period, and they called that because of the beakers that they made and the patterning on it.
Oh, really?
It's,
right. Okay.
It's very significant. Oh, it's very fixed to them.
Yeah.
You know, there was a period in which people were creating this kind of pottery, and because that's what's been left behind. Remember, that was only part of their culture, but we call it the Bell Beaker culture because that's all we've got hold of. And their monuments.
Yeah,
that tell us anything about them at all.
Yeah.
So it was reused in that period, and how long it stood there into the landscape, who knows?
But
it may well have been sort of finally ploughed. I mean, when you're there, you can see this gradual sort of slope.
There absolutely is.
Mound on the ground, but it's not, you wouldn't walk up to it and go, oh, look, there's a burial mound.
You'd walk past it, wouldn't you?
You know, it just looks like some grass.
You know,
or wildflowers in the appropriate season.
Yeah, and I imagine at the right to the wall, there were probably thousands of people that walked past it.
Walked past it, had no idea. And the fact that they've put an information board there is the only thing that really tells you there's anything there. Mm. However, it did influence the creation of the main central monument at the Arboretum.
Yeah.
So I spoke about what would it be, about 12, 13 years ago, I spoke to the architect to ask him if, when they were creating that mound, if they had looked at prehistoric British culture prior to that. And he said, we absolutely did.
Yeah, okay.
We absolutely did.
Right.
When we created that mound, it was a nod to the past. You know, and a nod to the fact there'd been a mound, not as big as that one, perhaps, but not far off.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been comparable, not quite, but, you know, of a something of the similar order.
Yes, yeah.
A monument on top of which the artist who created that Gates of Dawn, is it?
Yeah, I see. But what a thing that is.
I know.
It really is.
The, you know, the light strikes through the gates of eternity at 11 o'clock on the 11th of the 11th.
Yeah.
Year in, year out, forever.
Yeah.
You know, we could talk about the noon posts across the National Forest and all that, but the ancient British cultures were doing that. They were playing and understanding and engineering
across the pagan culture,
across, you know, this is sort of
Newgrange, this is exactly Stonehenge, this is you know, all that sort
Bryn
of stuff.
Ketley Thee in Wales, all of these places are
possibly Anchor Church,
possibly Anchor. We'll talk later in another podcast maybe about what we think we found there. But they were manipulating their understanding. They were manipulating people's understanding in that period of the connection between the sky and the earth, the movement of time, you know, our place in the world, all those things that we wrestle with still now.
Yeah.
They were wrestling with just the same things.
Yeah.
Understanding who they were, why they were, where they were. And ultimately, the thing I think that connects us now here with that is the river.
Yeah,
because the river is the connecting piece. It flows through geography. It flows through time. It's the thing that connects us with our ancestors.
Yeah,
and how they manipulated the landscape. And I think that's really important for us, for our culture, for our identity.